Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 30th of March. The merits of cancer screening this hour of the program. What do we make of the prostate cancer screening studies, two studies that came out just last week? And there have been just all kinds of different studies on what about breast cancer screening, what are the guidelines now, what kinds of cancer screening may be beneficial, what's just in the initial stages? Are there screenings that both of our guests believe should not be done at this point in time? And what about those we think of pancreatic cancer and Justice Ginsburg, who had surgery for that a while ago, and there is no screening for that. Will there be screening for many forms of cancer down the road? We have two guests with us in our studios here in Milwaukee, and we already have a ton of phone calls coming in. Dr. Doug Evans is with us. He's a cancer surgeon with the Frederick and Medical College of Wisconsin Clinical Cancer Center and Chair of Surgery at the Medical College. He is a pancreatic cancer specialist, also has specialties in thyroid cancer, inherited endocrine tumors, adrenal tumors, and carcinoid tumors. Dr. Evans, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Also joining us in studio, Dr. Amanda Kong, who is a breast cancer and breast disease specialist with the Frederick Medical College Clinical Cancer Center and a member of the Medical College faculty. Dr. Kong, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Could we start, just because it was in the news last week, with the merits of prostate cancer screening studies? And I guess people who have screenings for other kinds of cancers think when they hear this study, well, we seem to have two studies that say somewhat the same thing. Cancer screening, it was all over the news. Maybe for prostate cancer is not very beneficial. It might be harmful to me. I think people come away with that and they decide not to have it. There have been other kinds of screenings for other kinds of studies concerning other screenings. But your comment, let's start with you, Dr. Evans, on that. Were those studies right on the mark, or were there problems with them?
Well, like anything else you read, it often requires some editorial comment. We're continuing to look for that the holy grail of how can we live forever, and that certainly is what all of us, especially those of us who are getting older, would like to have. Unfortunately, as of right now, you can still be sure of at least a couple things: death and taxes. Mm-hmm. And as we get older, obviously there are a number of reasons why we may die. Heart disease, lung disease, things other than just cancer themselves. Mm-hmm. And as people get older, because our cells continue to mutate as we get older and have a relatively defined life expectancy, the incidence of cancer will increase, but also the risk of treating those cancers also increase. So with the prostate controversy, basically what the authors were saying is that it becomes very difficult as you care for patients older in age to weigh the risk and benefit of cancer treatment. When dealing with someone who is in their late 70s or early 80s, what you really need is a crystal ball. Hmm. If you know that they're going to live another 10 or 12 years, then obviously the time, effort, to some degree pain and suffering that they may endure with cancer therapy obviously would be worth it. If on the other hand, the crystal ball said that patient may only live a year or two or 3 years, then obviously it wouldn't be worth it. I think we've all been to a wake or a funeral for a member of our family or for a close friend where after the proceedings and people are sitting around the kitchen table, they say, you know, why on earth did the doctors do that operation? In retrospect, mm-hmm. It really didn't help how long she or he lived. Well, obviously, the doctors didn't know. I think doctors will always weigh risk-benefit. What the prostate cancer controversy is about is that subclinical or cancers that will not become clinically evident or important are present in a lot of men as they grow older, and that finding those has limited value if the life expectancy of the patient becomes relatively modest, and the number they used was less than 10 years. Hmm. So if you're 75 years of age and you're probably going to live less than 10 years, and again, in some cases that's difficult to determine, then screening for small, tiny cancers is clearly of limited value. That doesn't mean that screening for cancers is not real important in otherwise very healthy 75-year-olds who may live to be 85, 90 years old.
Mm-hmm. What about 50-year-olds?
Absolutely. No question. Mm-hmm. But it's very important for otherwise healthy 50-year-olds, especially those at high risk with a family history. African-Americans are more likely to get prostate cancer than Caucasians. But clearly at age 50, a PSA should be part of a routine health maintenance evaluation on a yearly basis.
Mm-hmm. And with breast cancer, maybe I'm wrong about this, but I have the impression that breast cancer screening and mammography has been around longer perhaps than other screenings. It is recommended. Most people I know do get mammograms after the age of 50 every year. Is there controversy concerning screening for breast cancer? Or not?
So actually, the current guidelines, as per the American Cancer Society and the National Comprehensive Cancer Network, which most practitioners run their practice by, suggests that you should start screening at the age of 40 and annually. There's also the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force. They say every 1 to 2 years after the age of 40. But this has actually been going on for quite some time. They've done some studies throughout the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And they've shown that for women between the ages of 50 and 69, screening actually lowers the risk of dying by about 30%. And for women in their 40s, in about 17%. There's been some recent reports in the news about a study that came out of Norway saying that are we over-screening people and do cancers actually disappear? And I think we have to actually critically evaluate these studies when we look at them before we can make any definitive conclusions. In that study, they screened a group of women for 6 years, and they saw how many cancers they found at the end of 6 years. They screened them every 2 years. And then they took a group of women for the same period of time for 6 years. They didn't screen them at all. And at the end of 6 years, they looked at how many people had cancer. And they found there was a lower rate in the non-screening group. So their conclusion was, well, there's a lower rate in the group we didn't screen, so the cancers must have disappeared. Mm. But I think that if we look at that just from common sense-wise, if you're going to screen more, you're going to pick up more cancers. And we've seen throughout the breast cancer literature that patients who have lower stage of cancer have higher survival rates. People who have stage 0, stage 1, they have 100%, 99% five-year survival rates. Nice. So I think that screening is very important, breast cancer screening for women starting at the age of 40.
Well, let me ask both of you then, why don't they get these studies right? Why can't you just, it sounds like there are problems with some of these studies right from the get-go, and it leaves people with confusion about what they ought to do and how effective screenings may be. Why aren't there better ways to conduct these studies to make sure they're a little bit more foolproof?
Well, I think unfortunately, a screening for cancer is expensive, and someone has to pay for it. And we're with all of the controversy right now regarding the costs of healthcare, this becomes very important. So, from the standpoint of, I think what the prostate controversy tried to convey to physicians, and to a lesser degree to prospective patients, is that as patients get older, if they have multiple other medical problems, which are very obvious, some degree of congestive heart failure, chronic lung disease, issues that would pretty much prevent aggressive anti-cancer therapy, it probably is of little importance if you then were to find that cancer. I think we have to then merge this information and the reality of this information with how we practice medicine in this country, with a population that is extremely well educated and overall a fairly aggressive minded physician and patient population. And I think that's where it becomes difficult. The longest discussions I have with patients are with the patients and their families for whom I am not going to operate on them.
Really?
Where medicine has little, overall little value. How to maintain hope in the cancer patient while also describing the reality of the situation is very difficult. And those are the longest discussions. Mm. For a patient who has a straightforward newly diagnosed cancer that needs an operation, even if that operation is of large magnitude, that's a relatively easy discussion in an otherwise healthy patient. Mm. As the patient becomes older, the concern over their recovery becomes much more complex. The issues with regard to caring for themselves, living alone, the possibility of ending up in a nursing home, you can see how that it becomes very complicated. Mm-hmm. And that's what all this controversy basically was centered around, that in the older population who has other health concerns, we probably don't need to be applying standard screening recommendations.
Yeah. And with respect to breast cancer, and actually any data, it's how you spin it and how you want to interpret it. So I know a lot of patients will come to my office and they'll say, well, you know, should I get an MRI as part of screening? And I tell them there's no definitive data to show that MRI is as effective as mammography or ultrasound. And in fact, there are many more false positives, which leads to more biopsies and more anxiety over these biopsies. And there's really very few patients who fit into the category of who should receive an MRI.
So where have patients been hearing that they should get MRIs? Is it that another study that's been done?
No, I think that the media I think the media promotes things and says, oh, it's more sensitive. It picks up many more things. And it's true. MRI is more sensitive. However, it's less specific. Mm-hmm. And so we do have more false positives in that sense.
Well, let's talk about the media for a moment then. Is the media problematic in helping you do your work here with all these studies that, boy, the press is on them right away? Because I think you're right. People want to live forever and they want to make sure they don't have something that could develop into a very serious disease. Are we not doing our jobs the way that we should?
I don't know if I would go that far. I think it's just a difficult situation in this country where you have such an educated population of both patients and critical reviewers, i.e., the media, and the cost of healthcare is also so high. I mean, for example, with new drug development in medicine, even though we conduct very carefully done clinical trials, we can if a drug proves to be of value, we can never get that drug to the patient quick enough. Yet, by the same token, if a patient dies in a phase one trial of a new drug, we will be criticized for not evaluating that drug with enough rigor prior to introducing it into the patient population. I think the lay public needs to understand that the amount of regulation right now imposed on medicine with respect to new drug development and advances in science is huge and greatly adding to the cost of our healthcare. For example, right now, if you take just the issue of patient privacy, one of the things that Amanda and I are introducing into MCW and Frederick Hospital is a tumor banking program. You can't do translational research where you study human tumors because we're very good at curing cancer in mice. We're really good at that. The problem is there's a big difference between a mouse and a person. And the amount of regulation in order to simply take a piece of leftover tumor from the operating room and use that for laboratory research is absolutely enormous.
Really?
The number of consent forms, the number of regulatory boards that you have to go through, all under the guise of patient privacy. And I would submit to you that more patients are concerned that they will die of their cancer than they are that someone may know that part of their tumor is in an immunocompromised mouse in my laboratory.
Right, right.
So
exactly.
I think we have a ways to go, but we will slowly get there. Programs like this are critically important.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I was just going to add, the internet has had a great impact on what patients, where they get their source of information, what they come to the office with. And patients often come to me and they found random websites with odd things in it. And what I do is I don't discourage patients using the internet because I think that knowledge is a form of empowerment for my patients. But I usually guide them to websites that are valid and tried and true. So websites such as the National Cancer Institute or cancer.net, which is sponsored by the American Society of Clinical Oncology. And these are patient-friendly sites, and they're unbiased and they're literature-based. So I don't discourage it, but I think that we just have to be careful about what all forms of media portray.
It is amazing when you go to some of those, and we all, maybe you don't, but many of us do go to those sites, and it's amazing how many people just list and believe, well, you take this vitamin or you take this whatever it is, and it's going to cure you. It's, we're so gullible in that regard. Again, I think because we want to live a long time and be healthy.
No question. I think we right now we live in a capitalistic society, and I think one thing I mention to patients every week is that you can be fairly sure that it is unlikely that you will find a miracle cure in a strip mall or on some obscure internet site, because Big Pharma, which I think takes an awful lot of unnecessary criticism many times, clearly wants to not only help patients, but they also strive to make money for their for their shareholders. So anything that is promising will certainly make its way to the clinic in this country as fast as humanly possible. Mm. With respect to the common solid tumors, we've even placed a lot of information in the last 2 months on our website in the Department of Surgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin with respect to breast, thyroid, pancreas, colon, the common solid tumors. That information is all there.
Great, and that's just how do you get there? Because people, you just go to just Google Medical College of Wisconsin.
Or just www.mcw.edu,
okay.
And then go to surgery, and it will be there.
Okay. Isn't this modern world something? You can do that.
Very helpful.
Now, what about, we have a ton of phone calls. I want to go to them in a moment. What about, though, you hear Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg, who had pancreatic cancer, and you, people get alarmed because you hear there's no screening for that. It's undetected. She got it in an early stage, which is great. This is your special area. Why are there some forms of cancer that you just can't detect? There's no screening for them. Will there be?
Well, we certainly hope so. Pancreas cancer is not that common. The likelihood of a patient getting pancreas cancer is 1/100 of 1%. So it's relatively uncommon, but it is but our success rate with therapy is also modest, which means that the mortality almost equals the incidence. So pancreatic cancer right now is the fourth leading cause of adult cancer death in this country, and as people grow older and their lifestyles improve, we're making progress in lung cancer. We have much improved screening for colon, breast cancer. Mm-hmm. So as our improvements increase in those areas, pancreatic cancer is going to become a bigger piece of the overall problem of cancer therapeutics. Unfortunately, the majority of patients who get pancreatic cancer, it's a sporadic event. About 20% of cases are probably tobacco-related and occur in people with a long history of smoking. Mm. Probably 5% or less are secondary to an inherited predisposition. Mm. Very select, uncommon group. The majority of people who get pancreas cancer are otherwise healthy, uniquely good people who develop this disease. If the tumor does not develop close to the bile duct, which causes the bile duct to obstruct and cause them to become yellow, then they will not get symptoms until the cancer is oftentimes far advanced. In our laboratories and others, we're working feverishly to try to develop a blood test for this disease, similar to the PSA that is used for prostate. Genetically, pancreatic cancer is a much more complicated disease. Mm. It occurs due to a series of complicated genetic mutations that occur over time. Mm-hmm. For patients who do have two first-degree relatives with pancreatic cancer, they should undergo periodic screening. The current screening that we would recommend would be a yearly MRI of the pancreas and one blood test called a CA19-9, which is a commercially available blood test that also can be obtained quite easily. That test is not perfect, but right now it's the best
we
have.
That's what you have. Yeah. Let's go to phone calls. We'll take them in a moment. Our number is 800-486-8655. Cancer screening, the merits of cancer screening, our topic this hour. And our guests are Dr. Amanda Kong, breast cancer and breast diseases specialist with the Frederick and Medical College Clinical Cancer Center, a member of the medical college faculty as well. Dr. Doug Evans, cancer surgeon with the Frederick and Medical College of Wisconsin Clinical Cancer Center and chair of surgery at the medical college. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Or the email, you can do that too. That's talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls, 800-486-8655. Gene from Oshkosh is our first caller. Hello, Gene.
Yes, good morning, Kathleen. It's a pleasure to hear your voice this morning.
Thank you, Gene.
And welcome to your guests. I tuned in a bit late, and I have not read the studies, but I have had prostate cancer. And as I listened to the conversation, is the question, should men have the PSA? And I'm having trouble getting my mind around that, even asking the question, because I've had some friends that have died from prostate cancer. I had mine 10 years ago, and after doing considerable research, decided on brachytherapy and have been inordinately pleased with it, and I don't view it as any sort of a problem anymore. But when men get together and talk about their health after a few beers, they do. Prostate cancer is an important issue for the male.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they'll ask each other, well, how is yours now? And they put you on a waiting program, you know, let's watch and wait and so on. So I guess my point really is, why are we questioning the use of PSA as a yearly screening device when its cost is certainly much, much lower, and it, I believe, catching that quickly and following with biopsy to determine whether it's actually there is a real life-saving procedure. And I'll take my answer.
Thanks, Gene. All right, thanks for the call. Dr. Evans, you want to take that?
Well, he brings up a great point, and my dad is 81 and also a prostate cancer survivor.
Really?
And when he was first diagnosed now about 10 years ago, I was, even though that's not my field, I was very much involved in the decisions that Gene went over with regard to surgery, brachytherapy, external beam radiation therapy, et cetera, as treatment options. But what the controversy is about now, Gene, is really and any study that begins to look at cost of benefit ratios in this country always gets a lot of attention, because in this country we want the best possible care. We're not sure we want to pay for it, mm-hmm. but we definitely want the best possible care. And all these studies said was that the value to the taxpayer, if you will, becomes modest in doing screening for common cancers of relatively modest malignant potential as the patients become older with other associated health concerns. So a 75, 80-year-old man who has other health issues, has two or three coronary stents, has chronic lung disease, is relatively inactive, whether or not he develops a prostate cancer is probably not clinically relevant, because he's not someone who would be treated with radiation therapy or surgery. Mm. That's really all they, mm-hmm. all these studies were discussing. No one was questioning the value of a PSA test beginning at age 50 in the general population. I think that certainly is something that we want to continue.
Mm-hmm. As we always talk about cancer, I think we forget sometimes what our largest killer is in this country. For example, for women, it's heart disease, mm-hmm. more than breast cancer. But mm-hmm. I think we tend to focus on cancer as it is a very politically driven disease, but actually heart disease is the top killer.
What do you mean it's politically driven?
I think that it receives much more media attention than heart disease. And we have a lot of fundraisers for it, and that's great. We need that to continue to do the research. We need to find treatment. But I think we also need to not forget that there are other medical problems that will kill us first.
Yeah. So we're not going to live forever. We're not going to push that boundary during our lifetimes, huh? To 200? I don't want to live that long anyhow. I don't think so.
Unfortunately, as we understand it now, and for those listeners who remember their high school biology, is our cells have a limited ability to replicate. And the important part of that DNA strand is the telomere at the end. And our telomeres only have a certain ability to replicate. So as of right now, we don't have the ability to live forever. What is fascinating, and the subject of an intense amount of research that we are doing and others, is individuals' ability to repair DNA damage. Many of your listeners probably have had relatives who, for some reason, they smoke too much, drink too much, they're overweight, they don't exercise, and they're in their 90s and just ticking along and doing great.
Yeah.
And people say, well, how can that be? But we have actually studied those individuals, and they have a much more robust capacity to repair DNA damage because cancer develops by a mutation in a single cell. The body's response to that mutation is to either fix the mistake in the DNA replication or to say, this mistake is too profound and we therefore have to kill the cell. Either mechanism works. And the enzymatic machinery that we have in our body to do that, which occurs every single day, thousands of times over, is more robust in some individuals than others. In fact, the big push for individualized cancer care, which we certainly plan to introduce with regard to pancreatic cancer in the next year and a half or so, will be to study the DNA repair capacity and other unique aspects of an individual by drawing their blood and amplifying their DNA, combined with a study of the genetic profile of their tumor.
Isn't that interesting?
And then tailor the therapy specifically with regard to those two pieces of information.
And you'll be
actually doing that in breast cancer already. Yes, there's a test called Oncotype DX. It's a 21-gene assay. Mostly the oncologists use it, but it provides an individualized prediction of chemotherapy benefit and 10-year distant recurrence rates in women, in certain specific groups of women. Basically, people who have no lymph nodes involved, who are hormone receptor positive patients, we already use that to decide whether they should receive chemo and if it would be beneficial for them.
Mm. Interesting. All right, let's go back to phone calls. Debbie is next from Waukesha. Hi, Debbie.
Yes. There's a new approach, another approach, which I myself have explored and had success with. In the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, in September 20th, 2005, the National Institute of Health presented an article on pharmacologic ascorbic acid concentrations and vitamin C given intravenously in high doses is selectively kills cancer cells.
All right, let's get the doctor's response to that. Intravenous vitamin C.
What disease site was that reported in?
Pardon me, what?
What type of tumor was that used for? That was used to treat established.
It was quite an extensive human lymphoma cells and others. I think it was quite an extensive general use because it has been used quite often. Linus Pauling, advocated vitamin C heavily. And there is a clinic in Wichita that has been there for 30 years now and has done quite a bit. I myself had a kidney small tumor shrunk, and it does. And it also, they advocate, which I find so interesting too, have unexpected implications for treatment of infections where H2O2 may be beneficial. The new virus are untreatable and not responding to antibiotics.
All right, let's get a response. We have a lot of people on the line. Dr. Evans?
I would just say that the National Cancer Institute, at their website, also provides information on all alternative therapies. And the NCI spends a large amount of money every year in the very careful analytical investigation of the alternative therapies that may be proposed in various disease sites. So it does not at all go unnoticed. Megavitamin therapy in general for established cancers has not been shown to be statistically significant with respect to a therapeutic benefit. That doesn't mean that paying attention to diet, appropriate vitamins, and generalized health issues once you're diagnosed with cancer is not important. It's extremely important. The overall relationship of the tumor to the patient, or what we call the tumor-host relationship, is affected by a variety of important issues, stress, diet, exercise, all of these. And that's why certainly at our cancer center, over the next couple years, all of these areas of alternative therapies will be available, from meditation to exercise therapy. Dietary counseling is already professionally available, but all these are very important for the cancer patient, no question.
Yeah, I think patients always ask me, you know, what can I avoid? What can I do to prevent anything? And I tell them just to live a general healthy lifestyle. Live in, eat things in moderation, don't do things in excess, exercise, be happy, and live well.
I think that's great advice. Thank you very much, Debbie, for the call. Our number is 800-486-8655. We go to Dennis next from Racine. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
Hi.
I think the prostate cancer controversy is important because it doesn't seem like men over 75 will have the PSA done as part of their routine exam. And I have advanced prostate cancer, and the hormone ablation treatment is working well for me. And my neighbor across the street, he's 84 now. 4 years ago, he was diagnosed as part of the PSA being part of his regular exam. He's very happy and doing well. He's on hormone ablation treatment, too. We kind of know that this is like healthcare rationing that's going on for men over 75. But we're disturbed at the scary, you know, side effects, that the so-called terrible side effects that they don't want to put old men through. Well, they're really not terrible. There's a little incontinency, maybe about 2%, and needle biopsy. Yeah, every time you put a needle in one's body, you're going to feel something. And as far as the impotency problem, you know, that's not really a big concern for men that at that age. He's glad to be alive. He's doing he's under the same hormone therapy I am. He plans on living well into his 90s. And one more point. There was a European study that did find efficacy in the PSA exam, unlike the American study. And I think the European study was much better done.
All right. Thanks for your call, Dr. Evans.
I think Dennis brings up a point that has been echoed by many cancer specialists. In other words, what Dennis's point is that more information is in general always better than less information, and that why have our head in the sand? The recommendation from the articles was that if not to do the PSA if they're over 75 with a life expectancy of less than 10 years. But as we discussed earlier, without a crystal ball, that's hard to determine. And what the cancer specialists say is, let us talk to the patient. It still is better to have the information and then have that discussion on risk-benefit ratio of therapy. Look at the side effects, look at the potential benefit, and then between the doctor and the patient, make an informed decision. Exactly the point that Dennis brings up. I think as long as that discussion is had, the right choice will usually be made. Yeah. But good point.
Yeah, very good. We had somebody who did exactly as you suggested and went to your website and said, I got to give the information because our listeners are doing this now, couldn't locate the page with the cancer information that was mentioned, but is on the website. So it's on the
Frater website.
Well, oh, it's on the Frater
they
website.
They can access it. Well, if they're sitting on the Department of Surgery website,
I think
right
they
now.
Are, yes.
Yeah, they can pretty much see a lot of the pancreas information is on the left, the breast and thyroid and other disease sites is on the right. And that once they click on that, it will take them into the Frater Cancer Center website, okay, where then there is a plethora of information.
Good. Another way to access it is to go to the Frater website and look under specialty areas, and then you can pick it by disease site.
Okay. All right. So there you go. You'll be able to maneuver that site just fine. What about the just generally, and maybe I should ask this more specifically with certain kinds of cancers, but take it to whatever kinds of cancers you want. What about how sophisticated the testing is now? Have we seen a vast improvement in early detection of breast cancer because mammograms are much more sophisticated? I would imagine that prostate cancer screening hasn't changed very much, but I'm wondering about the whole advancement of screening as a whole for cancer.
So in terms of breast cancer, I think women have seen a change from conventional mammography to digital mammography, and not all centers are carrying that. At Frater, all of our mammograms now are currently digital. And I tell patients it's sort of like VHS and DVD. The conventional mammography is not as clear if you look at the actual film as digital mammography. However, they have done large studies. There was a trial called the DMIS trial looking specifically at whether conventional mammography was equivalent to digital mammography, and they found that it really only benefited younger premenopausal women who have dense breast tissue. However, you know, the clarity on a digital mammography is pretty incredible. So, you know, at Frater, that's our standard there. In terms of use of MRI, that's also we brought that up earlier.
Right.
That has also come into the forefront of breast imaging. And again, there's only certain populations who really it should be pushed in. Patients who are have a known genetic mutation, we'll screen patients with MRI. Those who have that's such as the BRCA1 gene or the BRCA2 gene, which most people have heard about, or people who have had prior radiation as a child for something called Hodgkin's disease, we'll screen them with MRI as well. Those are the patient. That's the patient population it really benefits. There are other exceptions as well.
Okay, let's go to Jenny from Oshkosh. Is next. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. I had a question. I was wondering what the benefits are of screening for cancers that there are no cures seen in the future. You know, such as the pancreas cancer, or, you know, I didn't know if you guys were going to be screening for, like, islet cell tumors or, you know, such as those types of cancers. And does that, when it is screened and it comes up positive as you will get these cancers or something, you know, does that kind of, you know, have bad benefits for, you know, the person's psychological wellness that's going to kind of bring them down in the end?
Well, I think the islet cell cancer she refers to is also from the pancreas. Just to give the listener a brief explanation, the pancreas has two main functions. Number one, it makes digestive enzymes, which help you digest your food. And number two, it makes hormones, the most common being insulin, which controls your blood sugar. The common type of pancreatic cancer that Judge Ginsburg got Pavarotti, Patrick Swayze, is a cancer of the enzyme processing cell. You can also develop a cancer of the hormone-producing cell, and that's, as the caller mentioned, that's been called an islet cell tumor. And that's what the Apple CEO, Stephen Jobs, was diagnosed with and is dealing with now. That's much less common, and also a number of patients with so-called islet cell cancer develop that as part of an inherited genetic syndrome, which has been of particular interest to researchers at the Medical College of Wisconsin for quite a while. But I would still submit that if we can find these tumors at an early stage, they will be more amenable to therapy. And from a global anti-cancer strategy, from a research strategy overall, our treatments are going to improve. Our treatments today are already better for pancreatic cancer than they were 5-6 years ago. So we certainly don't want to slow down on our efforts in early diagnosis, because our treatment options will be much more robust 5 and 10 years from now than they are today. So we clearly have to pursue both avenues. We have to both look at techniques for early diagnosis and strategies for more effective therapy. And, you know, that's the reason why Dr. Kong and myself are at the Medical College of Wisconsin. We're here not just to deliver the standard of therapy that's available today, but our charge, the reason we exist, is to find better treatments for patients 5 and 10 years from now.
Right. How was Dr. Ginsburg, or Justice Ginsburg's cancer discovered? Do you know?
I assume that she developed jaundice due to the tumor located in the pancreatic head, which is next to the bile duct, then results in the visual appearance of what we call jaundice. If the bile duct is blocked, a peptide called bilirubin blocks up in the blood, and you become yellow. The whites of your eyes are the first things, the first thing that is noticed. You also notice that your urine becomes slightly dark. Your stools become light, and it's an obvious event. And that's the way most people with early-stage pancreas cancer will present.
Yeah. More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we go back to your phone calls, 800-486-8655. Mike from South Milwaukee is next. Hi, Mike.
Hi. I'm a retired radiation oncologist and have treated hundreds of prostate cancer patients. And one thing that hasn't been addressed thus far in this discussion is the profit motive in American medicine.
Well, that's sort of the subject of another show, but go right ahead.
And there are many prostate cancer patients, especially elderly patients, who receive totally unnecessary treatment in this country because of the profit motive. The surgeon and/or the radiation oncologist stands to make $3,000 to $10,000 per patient. In contrast to Scandinavia, where the recommendation of the physician is not based on whether the physician will make money. And I wish your guests would address that. Cancer treatment in this country has become a multi-billion dollar business, and it's one reason our healthcare costs are so much greater than Western Europe, and our results, overall survival, life expectancy, et cetera, are no better. In fact, they're worse.
All right, Mike, thanks for your call. You want to start with Dr. Kong, Dr. Evans? I'd like to hear both of you respond to this. It's good.
Well, I would just say that it gets to the importance of ethics in medicine. And I think many of the regulations that are occurring in medicine today are trying to convert medicine from a profession to or trying to convert a physician from a professional to an employee. And when I went to medical school, and in my life certainly, this is a way of life. It's not a job. It's much greater than that. I mean, there is no better, more fulfilling. There is no better job than to be a physician. And certainly for Dr. Kong and myself to be cancer specialists, I mean, there are just there isn't anything else that we would ever do. And the thought of treating a patient contrary to how you would want to treat that patient simply for financial remuneration is awful. I mean, may that exist in this country at some times or in some places? I suppose it can, but it is it is just one of the most revolting thoughts that you could think of. And I would just remind the caller that oftentimes the decision of whether or not to treat a patient is very difficult. I mean, there are clearly fastballs down the middle. There are young, healthy people who come in with resectable tumors that get an operation. But there also are very difficult dilemmas where the patient has comorbidities. They may be of slightly advanced age. And I can tell you, having spent 18 years at the largest cancer center in the world, I've made mistakes on both ends. There have been patients whom I thought would be best served without aggressive therapy, and they have lived long enough to prove me wrong. And there have been other patients where I thought that they would be best served by aggressive therapy, and the side effects of the treatment have proved me wrong. So it's very difficult. And I think on top of that, you know, in this country, you will receive timely health care. In many other countries, you won't. And as someone who has traveled extensively through Europe and operated in many of the European operating rooms, given all of the problems we have with our health care system, I still would rather be in this country than any other country of the world. And I think I can guarantee you that there is not a surgeon in our department at the Medical College of Wisconsin who would treat a patient simply based on the fact that that a bill would be collected. I think that that clearly that just would not occur.
I absolutely agree with Dr. Evans. I think we make our decisions based on individual patients. As one of our other callers stated before, his neighbor is 84 years old, and he's being treated for prostate cancer, and he's happy and living a fulfilling life. I have an 82-year-old patient who teaches yoga 3 days a week and swims for an hour the other 3 days, and I'm not going to deny her care. You know, she's feisty and as healthy as any 50-year-old that I know. So I think that our treatment decisions are based on the individual and not financially driven.
Yeah. Thanks very much for your call. We go next to, Kathy is next from Rhinelander. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm also calling to discuss the profit margin aspect in medicine. I think that for one thing, mammogram is $300. I don't think that's too much for anyone to come up with. When we start using medicine and money, it's really not a business. It's a healing field. And I would hope that physicians would take that in, would use that as something very important. This is a human being. And money really should not have anything to do with it, because one way or the other, it will, that patient will be treated.
Dr. Kuhn.
I'd like to, you know, thank you for your support in mammography. I agree that, you know, women should receive mammography on a yearly basis after the age of 40. It catches cancers earlier. We can treat them earlier, and sometimes that results in less aggressive treatment. For women 65 and older, actually, Medicare pays every year for annual mammography. So, again, the costs of mammography are not exorbitantly high. It's when people start using things like MRI that are an indicator where costs actually are increased.
Mm-hmm. And there is, let's talk about the disparity here for a moment. I have read that it is, if you don't make very much money and you're having a problem with health insurance benefits, or you don't have insurance, which is a problem in this country, as you well know, do we need to address that to make sure that these screenings are available to everybody? Is that a significant problem in our country right now?
I certainly, access to health care has received some attention, and there's no question about that, especially if you begin to introduce systems, which I think will eventually appear over the next few years as options, which will cause people to have some out-of-pocket expense when they go to the doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, screening will remain covered. Cancer screening that we all agree is appropriate will remain covered in either any type of nationalized program or private insurance.
Mm-hmm.
But for simple things, to maintain some balance between abuse and non-abuse of the system, there probably does need to be some element of a copay involved.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to, thanks, Kathy, for your call, Adele from Brookfield. Hi, Adele.
Hi. I have another question related to the pancreatic cancer. My husband has two sisters that died from it not too long ago. They were told that the diagnostic test was the EUS, the endoscopic ultrasound. But wondering, well, about that, and also both of them had husbands that smoked pipes quite heavily. My husband did also, but has quit a long time ago. Again, wondering about those issues, you know, for him. And then he recently had one of those heart scans that you pay for on your own, and they were told that they can do a full body scan and sometimes with that, I guess, calcium score, pick up on pancreatic cancer. And so we debated signing up for that, wondering, is that a another tool?
Okay, we have about a minute left.
She brings up a couple of very good points. First of all, the total body scan I wouldn't do because it's not tailored for the pancreas, and it won't pick up something small. It needs to be a tailored exam, either with MRI or CT, focused directly at the pancreas. The endoscopic ultrasound is used in a research study that I was involved in that looked at high-risk individuals, and your husband would qualify as such. But outside of a research study, I personally would not do the EUS as screening. As mentioned, for him, I would do a yearly pancreas-specific MRI or CT. The MRI has the advantage of being associated with less radiation exposure, and then a serum level of CA19-9. So my choice for him would be 19-9 and a yearly pancreas-specific MRI.
Okay, that was good. You did that. You got radio down here. You did that in a minute. Just about on the money. Thank you both so much for being with us. Obviously, we could spend hours, and I hope you'll come back to talk about your individual specialties, too, because we have tons of phone calls and too much territory, but I really appreciate your being here. Dr. Amanda Kong, breast cancer and breast diseases specialist with the Frederick and Medical College Clinical Cancer Center, a member of the Medical College faculty. Dr. Doug Evans is a cancer surgeon with Frederick and the Medical College as well, and chair of surgery at the Medical College. He's a pancreatic cancer specialist and has other specialties as well. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the program. Thanks to Rob Schroeder for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And thanks, everybody, for all of your wonderful calls, as always. I'll be with you again tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. I'm Kathleen Dunn. News is coming up here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.